My name is Pam Gates. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm co-chair of the Social Action Committee and our representative to Moses, which works towards criminal justice system reform. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, though we recognize that we all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us and how we may perceive others. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender identity, family structure, age, or abilities. We have several announcements. Next Sunday is our annual in-gathering. Please bring a small container of water from home. Afterwards, our e-family will head, families will head to shelter number 2 at Lake County Farm Park. See the email Alice sent for more information. There is a brief parish meeting after the service on September 18th. Save the date for our fall fair after our service on September 25th. It's titled Building Our Future. There will be food, music, activities, self-guided tours, a mini live auction, and a raffle. Invite friends and family. And I think Renee had a couple more announcements.
There are zucchini and tomatoes in the lobby under the TV from Mary Mullen. And then also there are handouts related to today's organization speakers. It's on the back hymnal cart. So when you leave, you can get those. And I think there's like a sign up if you want more information. And then also a slight change in like the order of service is one of the speakers, Socorro Cortez, could not make it. But then there's additional people from the organization. So that should be really fun. Thank you.
Okay, now it's our chalice lighting. Dirk will read, and Barb Park will try to light the chalice.
Welcoming the Stranger by Tracy Bleakney. A child journeys far from home, fearful and brave, in need of safe harbor. Guided by this chalice, may we seek to understand the causes of flight, like the comfort of a candle flickering in the window of darkness. Let us welcome this child into our home with warmth, nourishment, and love. Would we not want the same for our own child, lost and alone in a strange land?
All right. Our opening music is number 109 in the Gray Hymnal, As We Come Marching, accompanied by Amber. Please stand if you can.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the story for all ages. Joelito's Big Decision by Anne Burlack, read by our Director of Religious Education, Alice Mant. We welcome adults as well as kids to come forward for a good view of the pictures while we listen to the story. After the story, we will sing them out, and the lyrics are in the order of service.
All right. It's called Joelito's Big Decision. Joelito awakened to the smell of chorizo frying. After a dreamy minute, he realized it was Friday, his favorite day. He loved Fridays because Mama and Papa took him and his sister Alma to McMahon's for burgers every Friday, rain or shine. From his window, he could see the 12-foot-high plastic head of smiling Sam McMahon across the street. On their car trip to Los Angeles, they'd counted 15 smiling Sams. He supposed there were thousands of McMahons across the planet. At 3 o'clock, Joelito and his best friend, Brandon, waited outside the third grade classroom for their younger sisters. Alma came out with Brandon's sister, Kayla, who was crying. "Brandon, someone stole your sister's backpack," said Alma. "We looked everywhere." "I loved that backpack," Kayla said. "It was practically new." "Don't worry, Kayla," Joelito said. "There are others just like it at the store." "Joelito Sanchez, you don't understand anything," Kayla replied. "I won't be getting another one for a very long time." The four walked home through a misty rain. When Joelito and Alma reached their building, they said goodbye to their friends and walked upstairs to their apartment. Joelito was still thinking about Kayla's backpack. Once he'd left his backpack on the bus, and Papa took him to buy another one the next day. At 6 o'clock, Joelito and Alma heard their parents coming home. "Ready to go?" Papa asked. "Ready for my burger," said Joelito. As they stepped outside, Papa pointed across the street. "Something's happening at McMahon's. Let's check it out." Joelito had never seen McMahon's parking lot so crowded. There were people of all ages and colors. They smiled at each other as if they were all friends. Many carried cardboard signs. Some signs said, "Low pay is not okay," "Si se puede," or "Strike for 15. From the rooftop, smiling Sam gazed down upon the scene. Joelito and Alma peeked through the crowd at the restaurant door. They could see that McMahon's was packed inside, but no one was standing in line or eating at tables. They heard Mama calling, "Joelito and Alma Sanchez, come here." But they kept moving towards the restaurant door until Mama called again. Then they turned around. At that moment, Joelito saw Brandon, Kayla, and their parents, Mr. and Mrs. Thomas, standing together and holding signs. Mr. and Mrs. Thomas cooked burgers at McMahon's. They had worked at a factory until the factory closed down. Then the family moved from their house with a backyard into a one-bedroom apartment, and they had to give their dog Cookie away. Brandon still talked about how much he loved Cookie. "What's going on?" asked Solito. Mrs. Thomas said, "We're picketing to let people know McMahon's doesn't pay us enough to support our families. We want $15 an hour, though even that's not enough. We should earn enough so we can pay our bills and go on a family vacation." Jolito thought about Kayla's missing backpack. No wonder she'd been so upset. He guessed Brandon's parents never came to soccer games because they had to work Saturdays at McMahon's. "Jolito, come stand with us and hold a sign," Brandon said. "Can't. Sorry, Fridays we eat at McMahon's," Jolito said. "Are you kidding?" said Brandon. "I thought you were my friend." "I am," said Jolito, surprised, "since kindergarten." "Well, if you care about me and my mom and my dad and the people they work with, you won't eat dinner here tonight." Jolito opened his mouth to answer, but he couldn't think of what to say. "Why doesn't Aquila just pay the workers more?" Alma asked. Aquila, who used to babysit for them, was a manager at McMahon's. Mr. Thomas answered, "Aquila doesn't decide how much to pay the workers. When someone buys a McMahon's burger anywhere on earth, a lot of that money goes into Mr. McMahon's bank account. He decides how much of that money to pay the workers and the managers, and how much to keep for himself." A small crowd had gathered around them, listening. Mr. Thomas continued, "It's a math problem, brother. One year, Sam McMahon was paid $9 million. I'd have to work 500 years to earn as much as Sam earns in 1 year. Mr. McMahon's bank account is bursting, and we can't pay the rent. He has way more money than he needs because he pays the workers so little." A TV reporter held a microphone in front of Mr. Thomas and asked, "Won't McMahon's have to charge more for hamburgers if they pay the workers more?" His answer would be on TV tonight. "Sam McMahon has $1 billion in the bank," Mr. Thomas said. "He could easily pay workers more without raising prices." Jolito's stomach growled. He glanced back at McMahon's, where the burgers were frying on a grill. They smelled so good. "Jolito," Mama said, "if we ate at McMahon's tonight, your abuelos would turn over in their graves. When your uncles and I were young, we worked from dawn to dusk picking grapes in the sizzling sun. Pesticides. No bathrooms in the fields. Picking grapes hardly paid enough to feed us. We were always hungry. Demonstrating to be treated more fairly saved your abuelos' lives." "Okay," said Jolito, "let's go to Power Burgers instead." "Can't eat there either," said Mr. Thomas. "The workers at Power Burgers are demonstrating too. Low-paid workers are demonstrating all over the world today." "Where can we eat?" asked Alma. A short, grandmotherly woman said, Try Cocina Las Olitas on 18th. They have great food, and the workers get paid fairly. There's no Mr. McCann getting richer every time someone buys a burger." Sounds good to me, Mama said. The crowd was growing larger as men and women coming home from work joined in. Let's go, Jolito, said Papa. You're the one who was so hungry. Jolito just stood there lost in thought. He felt hunger in his belly, but he was feeling something else too. I'm going to stay here with Brandon and Kayla, he said. Then I'm staying too, said Alma. Could you bring back takeout for us and for the Thomases? As the sky cleared and the setting sun cast a shadow over Sam McMahon's plastic head, transforming his smile into a frown. When Jolito and Alma joined the Thomas family, Kayla handed each of them a sign on a stick. The crowd began chanting, hey, hey, ho, ho, low wages have to go. Jolito began chanting too. He felt a new type of joy as he realized all the people there were making history together. The end.
We will now have a moment of silent meditation. As you sit and begin to focus on your breath and being here in this room at this time. Our presentation is Why You Should Care About Workers by Frida Ballard and Socorro Cortez. It relates to our sixth principle, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Frida Ballard is an organizer at Worker Justice Wisconsin and a grad student at UW-Madison. She has worked as a community medical interpreter and has seen the harm that is done to Latino workers in Wisconsin. Her background in housing cooperatives in Austin, Texas, as well as Madison, has led her into creating more inclusive low-income housing. Worker Justice Wisconsin allows her to continue that role in creating more opportunities to build power through worker cooperatives and collective worker organizing. Please help me welcome our guests from Worker Justice Wisconsin.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for that introduction.
And you can take off your mask as the speaker.
Okay, yeah. So my name is Frida Ballard. Is that easier for everyone to understand? Okay. My name is Frida Ballard. I'm an organizer at Worker Justice Wisconsin. I started in May, so I'm very new, but I've seen a lot happen in very little time. So what led me to Worker Justice primarily was when I started working as an interpreter during the pandemic, it was very evident the kind of disproportionate harm that was done to workers, not just directly because of the pandemic, but also the work had to continue throughout all of this whole pandemic. And I saw a lot of workers that were getting injured on the job and would come into clinics asking for help. But the help that was offered medically was one thing, but every time a worker would come in with an injury, I feared that it would happen again and again. And I wondered about the conditions for all of the rest of the workers, because they were not, for certain, the only one. And this opportunity came up to be at Worker Justice, and I took that chance because it's, in my mind, same side of the same coin. And my work in grad school also focuses on discrimination in healthcare based on a person's accent when speaking English. So Worker Justice Wisconsin is a worker rights center. We're the only one in the entire state of Wisconsin. So by comparison, the city of Chicago has 8. So it is badly needed. We need more of them. There are other organizations that serve some other adjacent roles relating to immigration in particular. But when it comes to worker rights, it's a little sparse here in Wisconsin. So overwhelmingly, we serve Latino workers. So 80% of them speak Spanish as their primary language. 78% of them are immigrants from countries in Latin America. And the main issues that we encounter day to day are wage theft and discrimination. So workers not getting paid below minimum wage, at times even labor trafficking, especially on dairy farms. And obviously work conditions, so work conditions in factories and on dairy farms and in different jobs and different industries. So the workers that we deal with are especially vulnerable. They leave their countries and leave their families and leave all of their supports, give up all their comforts to come and try to make a better life for their families back home. It's really not even about themselves. They are in a place where their language is not spoken, where the services that could help them are not accessible to them for a number of reasons, either transportation-wise or linguistically or culturally. And even in the faith aspect can feel alienating. These individual workers that are really at the mercy of their employer. Every employment is a dictatorship, really, and it is a blessing if you have a benevolent dictator, but it's still completely out of your control. So what we try to do at Worker Justice is to eliminate as much as we can that element of chance of happening upon a good employer by collectively organizing workplaces so that they can all make the workplace what they want it to be, and not just hope for a good employer, but force that. So we invite at Worker Justice faith allies, as well as our labor allies at the Labor Temple, or our trade union allies. We invite them all to participate with Worker Justice in collectively organizing workplaces. And that can be in a million different forms. It can be showing up to pickets and rallies and protests. It can be donating to our Solidarity Fund. We have a fund that is set aside specifically for workers who are retaliated against for organizing. So workers that have their hours cut, that lose their jobs entirely, that are put on unpaid leave, that are outright fired. Because the point of the strike is to make their wallet hurt, right? And our fund is there to make sure that our workers can sustain themselves while the boss cannot. we want our workers to outrun the employer. So I think it is our duty, and I felt this also in terms of housing, that when we are in a position of privilege, when we have the opportunity to take a breather, to take a look at our surroundings, that it is our duty to give back to those who are in need. And one piece of scripture that we really hold on to at Worker Justice is the Gospel of Luke, chapter 14, that talks about sacrifice. There's a lot in this chapter about personal sacrifice. Our workers sacrifice everything for their families. There's a lot of personal sacrifice that they have endured themselves, of leaving their countries, leaving everything behind. And And in the end, often losing a lot of things. They lose family connections. They might not see their families for years. They might not see them ever again. And they often, in these hostile work environments, lose respect, and they lose dignity, and they lose their health in these unsafe workplaces. So what we ask is, what is something that we can sacrifice? We don't want any single worker to become a martyr for their cause, for organizing. So the way to disperse that out is for everyone to make a small sacrifice. No one has to make the ultimate sacrifice of, hopefully no one has to make the ultimate sacrifice of losing their life, but that happens in really these really toxic workplaces. But workers sacrifice their livelihoods when they organize. They sacrifice stability, which is so important in this chaotic world. It's so important if you're an immigrant to have some stability, a routine, and a steady flow of income. So we ask our allies to also make sacrifices, to also give up comforts in the way that our workers have to give up so many comforts in order to try to make a better life for themselves. So some of these sacrifices can be, you know, do I really need that kitchen renovation that'll increase the value of my home when I eventually sell it? Do I really need to purchase from that company that I'm not sure what their conditions are, or I've heard something about that workplace? Small things like that, or I'm going to call into work so I can support this workplace that badly needs community support. So these are the things that we really mean when we say sacrifice. It's considering what the things in your life, all the comforts that you have that were provided by people who gave up so much more, and what you can do in return as a give and take. So I'm going to give a couple of examples of kind of, one is sort of the worst case scenario, I think, of what I've seen so far. So I had a worker come in with a broken arm one day. I'm going to call him Daniel. He was an immigrant. He was working in construction. And his son had been convinced by a contractor to form his own LLC and to hire people underneath him. So what that meant was that he was forced to classify himself as a contractor instead of an employee. So he gave up his right to file a wage theft complaint if he was not paid, which he ended up not being paid. So he gave up that right, that the protection of the state to file a charge. He gave up, or he took on many responsibilities that were not supposed to be his. He had to pay all of his own taxes. He had to pay for workers' compensation, where he did not when he did not have the funds to actually follow through if someone was to get injured. And what happened was that this worker, he hired his father, and his father fell off a ladder and broke his arm, and suddenly had to pay all of these costs. And what ended up happening was the son became hostile and refused to pay for workers' comp insurance, and he refused to pay for his father's medical expenses. His father was unable to work because of his broken arm. He was behind on rent. He was facing eviction. He could not pay for food. He came to us in a very desperate situation, an immediate crisis. And we were able to give him some funds so that he could pay for gas, pay for food. We sent him to some resources for rent forgiveness. We also sent him some resources to help with immigration. But because his son had hired him, his son was the only person that was legally responsible and obligated to help with the workers' compensation. And the father did not want to fight his son. He didn't want to completely sever that relationship. And he gave up and he returned to Mexico. And he did not have a penny left. He had lost the relationship with his son. His son had threatened to call ICE on him if he insisted on getting paid for his medical expenses, and he lost his dignity. And that really sticks with me, because over and over again, I see workers that all of these things cumulatively mean that workers can't hold their head up. They don't have dignity. They can't be proud of what they do. They have nothing to show for it at the end of the day. However, with the power of collective organizing, we could change that around. So what we mean by organizing is workers often come to us with individual cases, so wage theft, discrimination, sometimes workers' comp, and they seek individual solutions. Oh, here got stuck. They seek individual solutions to their problems. But in a workplace, if one person is not getting paid, it's likely that none of them are getting paid on time or the correct amount, et cetera, et cetera. It's never a singular issue. So we try to reframe that into, this is, you're not the first, you're not the last, and you're not the only currently. And we encourage workers to bring all of their workforce, if they can, as much of them as possible. And we often find out that it is deeper and way worse than they even thought. And there's unfortunately, you know, if we went through the legal systems for the individual cases, there's many things that are, so wage theft is an enforceable thing if you're an employee, but not a contractor. And there's plenty of other things that are not enforceable because there's no laws for them. So if you're a roofer and you're on a house in the blazing sun for 14 hours, you're not entitled to a break, a single one. It's not in the law. So we can't go to the state for help. So that's why we really, really emphasize organizing, because we can go beyond what the law gives us, which is not even the bare minimum. And if we go through wage theft complaints with the state, sometimes they can only get minimum wage. Often they can only get minimum wage. So that's why organizing is so important, because the laws are not enough, and we can't trust that lawmakers will make those changes fast enough or enforce them fast enough, because it can take so long for these charges to be filed and to be sent off and to be finalized, that by the time it's resolved, they've already moved on to a different job, and there's another worker right in their place at that same workplace that is, again, going through the same wage theft, through the same discrimination, through the same mistreatment as the person before them. So it does not change the system. So with organizing, we hope to take the power away and to give it back to the workers who make everything possible. So to give a more uplifting example, this is very recent. This is of this last week, actually. This last month, we had workers come to us that had complaints of unsafe work conditions, primarily heat, extreme heat in the workplace, which is, thankfully this year, one of OSHA's national focuses of the year for the first time. They came to us because they were getting bounce checks, they were getting late payments, they were getting incomplete payments, and the conditions were bad and the treatment was abhorrent, complete lack of respect among, I couldn't even list off all the number of things that were wrong with this company. So they came to us and explained their conditions that they wanted to change. So we helped them write a petition inviting the employer to have a sit down with the workers and talk about how they could make these changes that they wanted to see to make the conditions better, to make it a fair workplace. And rather than engaging in dialogue, which is the bare minimum, just what we asked, he put the entire workforce on unpaid leave, which is blatant illegal retaliation. We were able that week, so this happened on Friday, not this past Friday, but the one before that. We filed with OSHA, we filed with the state for him canceling workers' compensation insurance. We filed wage theft complaints, and we filed with the NLRB. And thankfully, we recorded everything, and the NLRB saw it was so obvious and so blatant that after 3 days of picketing, they were able to get their jobs back the next Friday, which was faster than we ever thought was possible. But it was only because the employer walked right into the trap. Because these things don't happen as fast as that normally. They take months. They take months of effort. They take months of workers going to other temporary jobs to make this happen, putting enormous pressure on the employer. So this was sort of a miracle, we think. But our allies with the unions were able to stand by them. Our faith allies were able to console our workers and let them know that this isn't defying God. God doesn't want you to suffer. And you don't deserve the treatment that you're experiencing. And it is within Catholic doctrine to fight for yourself and fight for the working class. And that's a big part of why we reach out to faith allies, is that faith can be used against the working class, and it often is, but it can also be used to uplift them. And it is very powerful to our workers to see that faith leaders are with them, and it is okay for them to fight for their own dignity. A big thing that I have seen over and over is the shame that comes with fighting so publicly against your employer, of the embarrassment of having to face everyone, where your employer does not have to face up to their own actions, and the imbalance of power that you're trying to correct involves a lot of putting yourself out there. So when we try to mobilize our workplaces and our unions around them and the faith communities, it is very important for our faith allies to stand with them when they're out on the picket line. So thankfully, these workers have now been reinstated, but we continue on. The next step is now to actually sit down and negotiate. And that is probably the harder part of all of this, because it involves very nitty-gritty things, and it is outside of the public eye. So I have a few of those workers here with me right now. I'll be interpreting their messages.
Buenos días, mi nombre es Evelia.
Good morning, my name is Evelia.
Agradezco el que nos permitan estar aquí, porque eso es un apoyo para nosotros.
I appreciate you allowing us to come and speak in front of you guys, because that is a great support to us.
La historia de Juelito es mi historia.
Juelito's story that was shown earlier is my story.
Y la de mis compañeros de trabajo.
And that of my coworkers.
Esta excelente persona que está aquí, junto con otras 4 o 5 personas más, han sido nuestro apoyo. Ahora mismo es nuestro apoyo.
This wonderful person, along with 4 or 5 other people, that is Worker Justice Wisconsin, have been our support in all of this.
Frida ya les comentó por lo que estamos pasando. Solo quiero agregar que yo no sabía que existiera personas que nos dieran ese apoyo.
I just wanted to mention that in all of this, I was not aware that there were these organizations that could support us in this way.
Yo me iba a ir ya de ese trabajo, puesto que nunca he tenido un sueldo al día. Ahora mismo no me han pagado 4 semanas.
I had never previously had a stable salary. As of right now, I am still owed 4 weeks in wages.
Pero una compañera tuvo el valor de llamarles, y fue así como ha empezado toda esta lucha.
But one of my coworkers had the courage to call them, and that's how this whole battle started.
Y nuevamente gracias por estar aquí, y sé que ustedes son una voz más para nosotros y un apoyo.
And thank you for having us here. Having you is one more voice in our collective choir of support. So to just sort of reiterate why we're organizing, and the example of this case, this employer had previously had four other businesses in industries that are notorious for mistreatment, cleaning and construction and painting. They had previously battled with one of the unions, one of the trade unions, for undercutting, for unfairly lowering the prices by cutting wages about to a fourth of what they're actually worth if they were to join a labor union. And so that's an example that what really hit home for our workers and for different actions that we've done and other organizing committees is the example we reiterate, if you don't do something now, what will happen? And unfortunately, in this case of Jeremy Crook, who is the boss of these employees, what happened with him is that he started one business after another, exploiting immigrant workers, and then declaring bankruptcy and doing it all over again. So that is why we organize. We have to stop him. And if no one stops these people, it'll continue happening forever, forever, forever. And we will never run out of work. Right? The DWD will never run out of work, of wage theft complaints and discrimination, but nothing will improve. So some things that our faith allies can do to help our workers is, like I said, showing up to pickets. It means a lot. It means a lot to workers when people that don't know them personally at all show up because they care about them as a person. What we often see with employers is that they have a different definition of respect, that if they're not treated as an authority, they won't treat you as a person. But what we see often with these pickets is that our faith and our community and our labor allies just see them as people, and they treat them with respect because of the fact that they are human and not because they have any particular authority. And it means so much to us, to our workers, when strangers are willing to take time out of their day to support them. Another way that our faith allies can collaborate with us is that we offer trainings on how to organize your workplace that includes information on workers' rights, because often people don't know that they're experiencing wage theft. There's a million different ways you can have your wages stolen. So we offer trainings on that so that people can get the ball rolling on organizing. And we also, a big part of what we do at Worker Justice is cooperative trainings. Because workers can, from pretty much any industry, most industries can organize, but unfortunately, the NLRA that protects, that guarantees the right to organize, does not cover domestic workers, and it does not cover agricultural workers. So the people in the dairy farms that are so vulnerable, that are the most vulnerable to human trafficking, are not protected. They can be fired legally for organizing. And so in that case, that's why we start worker cooperatives, because that way they have the power themselves, no one else does. So if the congregation would be so generous, we would love to be here and offer those trainings to workers, and even to people that, even to just like other people in the community, to pass on the word of, hey, I was at this training and I think I remember that being a type of wage theft. Maybe you should look into that, right? Just the collective knowledge will permeate through the community. And also, importantly, we have a worker solidarity fund. So we have a fund that's specifically set aside for workers. It does not touch me. It does not go to my boss. It does not go to anyone except people who are laid off, who are retaliated against in some way for organizing. And that is extremely important in these types of actions, because You never know what employer is going to do. You never know if they're going to lay off the entire workforce in one go, immediately. And that's essentially what we do. Any questions for me?
Hi, I'm Randy Converse, he, her, he, him, I'm nervous here. I want to thank you all for your work and your courage, amazing work you all are doing. A couple of things I want to share with you. One is your work with worker cooperatives, I think, is a superb activity. And very few people look at unions as the only way to organize. And worker cooperatives, I think, are super important. I'm very impressed with that work. And now I have another part of my concern, a question. You talk about an organization that has one owner and workers. How do you organize in larger organizations in terms of how are members eligible to be part of the rank and file? And how doesn't that create some kind of artificial dichotomy in the workforce? That makes sense, that question? I guess I'm looking at a larger organization that has a management and workers, and I think sometimes mm-hmm. the management are sympathetic and are abused, but can't join the union efforts, and they get kind of lost, I think.
Yeah. So I'll go straight to that second one. So, yes, we do have a previous campaign that we just concluded a couple weeks ago, where the manager did join the rest of the workers. So it is possible, but obviously there is a difference between them. They do hold a different amount of power, but what we try to do is reframe that in, since they have power, sort of being a spy in a way. because they have a lot of different freedoms that the other workers don't get to have, and those freedoms come with different information that they could pass on to us. And sometimes they agree that they shouldn't even have those. That kind of difference, that dichotomy doesn't even really matter. And that they all have the same collective interests, because essentially what we look for in these workplaces is who's the common enemy. And often it's just the person at the very top. So we may start with talking to the immediate management, which might just be like a smaller supervisory role, but they still have some power. And if we are able to incorporate them, we will, but often they are not a part of it. And so we just bypass them. And eventually, sometimes they do realize at the end of the day that they do have the same interests, because they really do. And this is also the case with the construction industry. It's pretty crazy in its structure, but there will be the general contractor, then there will be a group of subcontractors for different specialties, and then they'll hire what are called labor brokers. So sort of the example that I gave of the son that was convinced to form an LLC, he doesn't have actual financial power. He's just a contractor by name, but in reality, he doesn't have the support and the bank account and the cash flow that the contractors do. So the labor brokers are in a way like the same as a supervisor, but they have the same interest as the workers that are under them, because they're also tricked into forming an LLC. They're also tricked into taking on a supervisory role, which put them in danger as well. So it is a lot of reframing and breaking that of you're not actually in power here. You're made to think that you have power, but you really don't. There's a lot of, and depending on what the supervisor role is, there might be a lot in common. There might be very little, just like a title change and like a salary versus hourly, and that's it. But in other cases, it's an actual huge difference. So we kind of go case by case on that.
Hello, my name's Andy, he, him, his. And I was wondering if there is a place, instead of going after people who have bad employers, is there a place where you know where there's good employers? You know, if I was going to get a roof, I wouldn't know who treats their employees well or who doesn't.
So in terms of the construction industry, yes. We work closely with an organization called the Construction Business Group, and they investigate construction specifically, exclusively. And they go and they do surveil different work sites and do investigations on different contractors. And they also collaborate with their trade unions on this. And we have a close relationship with them. We pass on names, see if it exists in their portal. We have an account with them, so we check their database. But oftentimes, there's something like 360 employers on that list. It's a bad list. And that's in the state of Wisconsin. And some of these contractors may operate all over the Great Lakes area. These are only the ones that have been caught. So there's obviously a lot more. And especially the smaller ones are the ones that are harder to catch. I had one contractor in particular that was had a worker came to me, was not getting paid, etc. Found out through CBG with our collaborative investigation that they, in our estimate, owed probably around $300,000 in wages to other people. And because they're contractors, they can't file wage stuff. They have to go through the courts. And if you're not owed $15,000 or more, it's not even worth it. And so that's how they got away with it over and over and over again. And there are 17 lawsuits, et cetera, against them.
I wasn't looking for who was bad. I was wondering if there was like a website where I could see, aha, this roofer is good, or this restaurant is good, or, you know, not the bad ones, but is there a list of who is good to go to?
Not to my knowledge. I hope so. I hope someone's doing that. Those are harder to come by, unfortunately, I think. I feel like there's a general kind of idea, especially in the last few years, of like, you know, buy small, buy local. But some of the worst offenders that I've seen are small and local and family owned, that devolve into the worst employers possible. I don't know. The Better Business Bureau is a pretty good source. If the client is being treated terribly, you can only imagine what the workers are being treated. So I think that's a good starting point generally, because the client is never supposed to be the one that gets the bad part of it. Okay.
Okay, thank you so much, Frida, and your guests. If you'd be willing to stay after to talk to people, there may well be more questions. I know I have a couple. Sure.
I almost forgot this. But if you want to find out more about worker justice and follow what we do, I have a clipboard up there with some information. If you want to follow our campaign currently with the screen printing shop with our workers here, I have a clipboard there that you can fill out. You can stay in the loop about that, and another one to stay in the loop about worker justice in general, and a flyer of our organization as a whole down there on the back.
All right, thank you for that as well. Okay, our next thing is... we're sharing our offertory this quarter with Wilma's Fund, which provides assessments and assistance to LGBTQ+ people who are experiencing homelessness, as well as support to prevent homelessness in this population. The offertory is Sonata in C minor, Opus 13, Rondo by Beethoven, performed by Amber. Thank you. Thank you, Amber. The closing words will be read by Dirk.
Wow. why businesses should support immigration reform. Immigrants make up as much as 73% of farm workers in this country, and Frida mentioned dairy farms in this state. That's also true there, too. Immigrant farm workers are pillars of the country's food supply chain and agricultural economic prosperity. They not only allow the United States to maintain a self-sufficient food supply, assuring a level of food security, but they also help our nation be the largest exporter of food in the world.
Thank you, Dirk. Our closing music is number 136, also in the Gray Hymnal, Where Gentle Tides Go Rolling By, accompanied by Amber. Okay, now we're stopping the recording.